When I was about 7 years old, I was at a friend's birthday party. We went to the local cinema with a group of six other kids, my friend and her mother. I had to use the bathroom during the movie, and I told her mom, assuming that she would come with me, because even then I knew going to places alone as a kid could be dangerous, but she didn't go with me. I went out to the bathroom alone. I must mention that it was a small local cinema which was really old, and most of the time it was empty. It wasn't like regular theaters nowadays that always have people bustling about. Anyway, on my way to the bathroom, I saw some guy leaning against the concession counter, seemingly with nothing to do. I thought maybe he was waiting for his kids to come out of the restroom or something. At this place, the bathroom was one small room that was divided into two halves. On one side was two stalls for men, on the other two stalls for women. I entered the bathroom and sat down to do my business. The guy came in about a minute after me. I could see his shadow under the door of the stall that I was in. He was walking back and forth outside of it. He shouldn't have been over on the women's side, and no one else was in the restroom with us, so I began to panic. I stayed in there for a couple of minutes because I was too scared to go out. He eventually left, and I decided to go back. When I walked out of the bathroom, he was standing there blocking the doorway, standing with his arms and legs spread out like he was ready to grab me and scoop me up. My heart started racing. He was more than twice my size, and I was terrified. I thought fast enough to jump through the gap between his legs. I skidded on the carpet and burned my knees, but I got up as fast as I could and ran back to the theater that my party was in. I wish it had ended there. That night at home, I remember hiding this doll that I had because I thought the man was going to come for me, and I wanted to make sure my doll was safe. My mom noticed me acting weird and asked me what was wrong. I blurted out that a man had tried to grab me when I was at the cinema. She kind of brushed it off, but I think that she was trying to act like nothing was wrong for my sake. I could see in her eyes that she was worried. Later, I heard her and my dad talking, and she asked me what the guy looked like. Did he have a black mustache? Did he have messy hair? He did. But how did she know these things? It turns out he was at our fucking house earlier that day, replacing a window, and he must have overheard me and my mom talking about the party. I don't know what he was planning on doing if he grabbed me. Was he going to kidnap me, or something else? I'm just glad he didn't succeed. I brought all of this up to my mom last night. She looked surprised for a moment, like she didn't think that I would even remember the incident after all this time. But how could I forget? She seemed uneasy talking about it, but I eventually got it out of her that the guy was never caught. I'll admit, when she said this, I had a moment of this sinking feeling in my chest. They never saw or heard from him again. She told me that the police had assumed that he had skipped town after failing to kidnap me out of fear of being identified. I can't help but feel worried though. Worried that he may have caught another kid, that they may not have been as lucky as I was. I really hope this piece of shit was scared out of attempting this again, and no kids were harmed.
I once asked my great uncle what his absolute worst memory was from his youth. He didn't hesitate at all when he told me that it was the night he went to go see the movie Dirty Harry, starring Clint Eastwood. It was 1971. It was at a small theater in Wyoming. My great uncle and his best friend had bought tickets for $1.50 each to get in to see the movie. The cinema had a single screen, and they were sitting in the very back row because they intended to smoke cigarettes and didn't want to be caught and thrown out. He recalled there being only about four or five other people in the theater. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the flick, Clint Eastwood played a loose cannon cop who was borderline insane and was on the hunt for a serial killer who called himself Scorpio. The plot was heavily inspired by the real-life Zodiac Killer, and it was mainly that reason the two of them had skipped school to check the movie out. My uncle was big into true crime and unsolved mysteries. He told me that as he was watching the movie, he was being distracted by what smelt like spoiled meat. Even the cigarettes didn't help hide the scent. Once the movie was over, his friend immediately wanted to leave and escape the putrid smell. But my uncle bent down and started looking underneath the seats out of curiosity. Two rows ahead of him, he noticed what appeared to be a meat patty laying forgotten, and he made his way over to it, confused about how it had been overlooked by the staff. When he reached the correct aisle and bent down, he then shot up again just as quickly and started freaking out and cursing in shock. What he had originally believed to be a harmless piece of hamburger meat was in fact an actual severed hand. It was a left hand with soggy gray flesh sitting in a thick stain of blood, and a handful of flies were buzzing around it. What was worse is that three of the fingers were detached and scattered across the floor not far away. My uncle told me that there was only one employee there at the time. He was a very overweight attendant who was sitting up front smoking a cigar, and the man didn't believe him at all until he actually brought one of the fingers over wrapped up in his handkerchief. When the attendant saw the finger, he grabbed it and headed over to the theater with a dustpan and broom, looking more annoyed than alarmed. Another one of the theater patrons noticed what was going on and went across the street to call the police. My uncle's friend didn't want to wait for the police to arrive and instead got on his bike and rode home. My uncle stayed and watched as the police questioned the attendant and the man who made the call. The attendant denied everything, even after my uncle spoke up and told them where he had found the hand. The police went inside the theater and apparently saw enough blood on the floor that they took the attendant in for questioning. But they never actually interviewed my uncle properly. He ended up just riding on his bike home, practically being ignored and forgotten by all the adults in the room. He never found out the exact story behind the severed hand, but he suspected the attendant and the other members of the staff may have tortured someone in there after hours, cutting off their fingers first before moving on to their entire hand. The theater was shut down several months later and eventually condemned. I asked my uncle why this was his worst memory and not his most exciting, and he simply replied, "Because whoever owned that hand was very likely murdered, and the killers will never be brought to justice." He says he can still remember the smell of the rotting flesh and the sound of buzzing flies circling around it. So back in the early 90s, there used to be this tiny drive-in movie theater in eastern Missouri along that narrow stretch of borderline with Kentucky. I would go there often with my two older brothers and younger sister during the weekends. We had this flatbed trailer that we would hitch up to our dad's truck, and we would set up our folding chairs and a cooler of beer and watch the movie from our mobile platform. Most of the time, we didn't really care what was playing. It was just fun to get out of the house and have an excuse to drink. I remember this night fairly well because my brother had chipped a tooth the day before and had an ice pack to his jaw. I don't recall the name of the movie we were watching. I think it was some cop movie or something. I had my Empire Strikes Back t-shirt on for some reason, and I remember being barefoot. This was one of the first screenings of the summer, and there were only two other cars in the lot. My brothers were arguing over something, and my sister and I were sharing the cassette player and headphones, passing it back and forth between songs. We were all smoking and drinking, and only half paying attention to the movie, when we heard someone yelling from the trees to our left. My brother raised his flashlight to scan the tree line, and after a few seconds, an Asian girl, maybe 18 to 20 years old, came limping out of the shadows. She was completely naked, except for a plastic bag around her waist, and there was a long nylon cord around one of her ankles. All four of us immediately jumped off the flatbed and made our way over to her. She was crying and gasping for air, and she collapsed to her knees. By the light of my brother's flashlight, we saw that she was bleeding from a gouge behind her right earlobe and had several bruises along her arms, face, and knees. My older brother took off his windbreaker and put it around her. We all began talking at once. I was suggesting that we carry her to the truck while my brothers were trying to talk to her, asking her where she had come from and what happened. My sister handed her a bottle of water and was trying to talk above everyone else, loudly proclaiming someone needed to go find a phone and call the cops. I noticed another one of the driving customers get out of his car to get a look at what was happening, and the owner of the lot was also making his way over to us from the entrance. The Asian girl continued to hyperventilate and sob.
and kept glancing back behind her into the woods. As far as I remember, she hadn't said anything until that moment when she called out, "Run!" She tried to leap to her feet, but staggered and collapsed into my brother's arms. I glanced up and pointed towards the trees, snapping at all my siblings to shut up. I noticed three figures wearing burlap sacks over their heads, carefully stepping out of the tree line. Until that moment, none of us had made note of exactly how long the cord was that the girl was dragging behind her. One of the men in the burlap sacks took a few careful steps forward until he was about 10 yards away. He slowly placed his foot down on the end of the line. The frantic girl started screaming. My sister and I were cursing at the masked men, and one of my brothers picked up a rock and told him to back off away from the cord. None of the men moved. I remember scanning all of them for any signs of a weapon, but they didn't appear to have any, at least nothing large and obvious. They were still mostly in the shadows, and the only way that I could really see them was the glare of the movie screen and the wandering beam of my brother's flashlight. As I type this out, I understand how ludicrous this must sound, and thinking back on it now, I constantly remind myself that it wasn't a dream, and I was on the front lines of a terrifying standoff that nearly resulted in bloodshed. The owner of the drive-in finally reached us and immediately raised a sawn-off shotgun directly at the face of the closest masked man and told him to get the fuck off his property. From behind us, I heard the sounds of tires rolling across gravel and glanced back towards the entrance to see two pickup trucks pull up, their headlights pointing right at our group. And for a split second, I thought they were there to help us, until I noticed the deer skulls mounted on their hoods. The trucks just sat there, idling, as silent as the three masked men in front of us. The owner didn't turn around, and didn't even flinch. He called out again that if they didn't get the fuck off his property, no matter what the guys in the trucks did, he was going to shoot the three of them at least. The brother not holding the rock had frantically been working with his bare fingers at the knot of the cord around the girl's ankles, but to no avail. And the lingering silence that followed, it was right then, when the thought first crossed my mind, that we might all die right here. After another few moments, the masked man removed his foot from the cord and took several steps back. His friends followed suit. Without turning their backs on us, they disappeared into the shadows, like unblinking phantoms. And once they were gone, the two pickup trucks spun out loudly on the gravel and took off down the road. The police arrived shortly after with an ambulance for the girl. A few officers combed the woods, but they didn't find anything the masked men had left behind. It turned out that the girl did not speak much English, and she claimed that her name was Hildegard, but that always felt made up to me. A week or so later, a man's body was found in those very same woods by hunters. He had been beaten to death. It may have just been a coincidence, but I think it was one of the burlap sack men whose friends had turned on him. After that night, we never saw or heard from the Asian girl again, though we inquired at the police station and hospital about her several times. I know that a few different TV news vans showed up at the drive-in, but the owner refused to give an interview and chased them off his property. Regardless of the event being reported and televised, the word got around, and the drive-in officially closed in 1992. The four of us were there at the last screening, before it was closed for good. The entire last week, the drive-in was playing Batman Returns, and we saw it three times. My eyes were rarely on the screen, though. More often than not, I was glancing over to the spot where the girl had emerged from the woods. I was always nervous that a masked figure might be standing there, staring back at me. During the spring of 2004, I was 19, even though I looked about 14. I was 5'0" and weighed about 100 pounds. That's if I was carrying laundry. My parents and aunt were vacationing in Mexico. I had decided to opt out and house-sit for my aunt. I figured it would be a nice opportunity to have a quiet place to study for my upcoming exams. And all I really had to do was clean the pool, collect the mail, and restock the fridge with groceries. I also had a plan of action that involved emptying her safe and rescuing her car in the event of wildfires. Her place was high up in the hills of Southern California, with a terrific view of Long Beach. I mostly spent my time in the massage chair in the guest bedroom, playing music in the background while I pored over my psychology notes. Occasionally I would sit out on the balcony and work on my tan, or use the treadmill in the basement, but I mostly was secluded in the air conditioning trying to be productive. Every night I would set the alarm and make sure the security cameras were working before I went to bed. But on the fourth night of my stay, I was really focused on the books and forgot to set the alarm after it got dark. At about 1:30 a.m., I paused to take a break. That's when I realized how late it was. My stomach sank as I remembered that the basement door was unlocked, and I had to secure it before setting the alarm. Before heading downstairs, I wandered into the study to get a look at the security cameras just to be safe. I remembered thinking to myself, what are the chances that someone may actually be inside the house? As soon as I finished processing that thought, I saw the figure on the basement stairs. I remembered my mouth falling open and making a small croaking sound. There was a middle-aged, balding man with glasses slowly making his way up the stairs. And to make the situation even more unnerving, in one of his hands he was holding a balloon. I stared at the cameras as he reached the top of the basement stairs and looked around before cautiously setting foot into the kitchen. My first thought was to slam the door, lock it, and call the cops. But deep down, I knew it would take the police between 10 and 12 minutes just to make it out here, and in that time, this guy could easily overpower me and drag me into the night. I suppose I could have hidden somewhere as well, but I didn't like the idea of trying to stay quiet while he wandered from room to room, searching for me. Instead, I decided to go on the offensive and try something, and it was both incredibly daring and amazingly stupid. I tiptoed back into my room, turned up the music, and then made a loud production of exiting the room, pounding my feet down the hall. I called out as loud as possible, "Marcus, I swear I heard something downstairs. Put on your shirt and grab the key to the gun cabinet." I was positive my voice was quivering as I said it, but I figured the music playing in the background would hide that fact well enough. I paused for a few seconds, waiting to see if he would call my bluff. But when all I heard was the silence from down below, I power walked back into the study, locked the door, and checked the cameras. Sure enough, he was scampering out of the basement door like a frightened squirrel. I watched him run across the backyard, around the pool, and disappear between the hedges. As soon as he was clear of the house, he let go of the balloon, and I watched it from my window as it lazily floated away towards the Pacific. I ran downstairs, locked the basement door, set the alarm, and called the cops. I also called my parents and aunt and told them what happened, asking them how I could rewind the footage to show the police. My aunt asked me why I didn't just hit the panic alarm on the security pad, and I had to admit that I hadn't even thought of that. To make a long story short, the police caught the guy a week later. He was sleeping in his car in a grocery store parking lot. Everyone always asked me what I thought the balloon was all about, and if I had to guess, I think it was a gift. This guy must have seen me a few times outside the house, surmised that I was alone, and assumed I was much younger than I really was. I have no idea if the guy is still in prison, but regardless of where he is, I kind of hope he hears this and feels stupid. He got scared away by nothing but the empty threat of a panicked girl with the strength of a malnourished gerbil. So this happened last year when I was house-sitting for my neighbor. He was in the hospital for a few days recovering from surgery, and I had been asked to stay in the house and keep an eye on his cats. The house was pretty small, but it was on a nice wide-open property by the woods. And there was a tiny swinging cat flap on the kitchen door, where the cats could come and go as they pleased. The flap led into a screened-in back porch, and the house only had one bedroom. So I chose to sleep on the couch in the living room. After cleaning up, feeding the cats, and watching some TV, I shut off all the lights and laid back on the couch. I had my phone out and was casually scrolling through Facebook when I heard the flap swinging back and forth. From where I was in the living room, I couldn't see the door because the counter was in the way, but I glanced over to see one of the cats scamper over and leap up on my legs. I gave it a welcoming pat on the head and continued scrolling. After another minute, I heard the cat door make a noise again, a soft squeak. This time, I didn't even glance over, figuring it was the second cat following the first into the house. Another few moments passed, then I heard the squeaking again, and then after another moment, it squeaked a third time. I looked up from my phone, wondering why the second cat was jumping in and out like that. I was wondering if I would have to scoop it up and put it in the bedroom. The door continued to squeak for another couple of minutes, as the second cat continued to jump in and out. I finally decided that I had enough. I put my phone down and sat up on the couch. I began to stretch. As I did, I happened to glance behind the couch, and my blood froze. The second cat was curled up in its bed in the corner, and the first cat was still nestled between my legs. My confusion turned to fear instantly. Was there another animal on the back porch? Another cat, maybe? I slowly stood up and carefully made my way over to the back door, tiptoeing across the carpet in my socks. The door made a squeaking noise again. I peered around the counter and felt the sensation of my heart leaping up into my throat. And at the same moment, my stomach dropped. By the faint rays of the nightlight in the hallway, I saw an arm reaching through the cat door, straining to get at the knob. The fingertips were brushing at the lock. For a few short seconds, all I could do was stare in terror, frozen by the surreal silent reality of what I was experiencing. It almost didn't feel real. The severity of the situation hit me, and I realized that if the intruder got in, I wasn't going to stand a chance. I grabbed a large two-pronged fork that was used for flipping steaks on a grill, and in one swift motion, I stabbed at the arm right below the wrist as hard as I could. There came a thunderous scream of pain from the other side of the door, and the arm was immediately retracted through the flap. But the fork had impaled the intruder, so it caught itself on the door. That produced a second loud scream, and the arm was wrenched violently outside. I heard the clatter of the fork on the ground, and then I heard footsteps sprint across the back porch and out the screen door. I immediately turned on the outside lights and caught the glimpse of a figure running towards the woods. Instead of calling the cops, I scooped up both cats, stuffed them into the same carrier, grabbed my phone, my shoes, and sprinted out to my car, which was thankfully parked inside the garage. I drove up the road a couple of miles to my place, and once I was safely inside, I called the cops. It took them half an hour to get to my place, and then another half hour of questioning before they continued down the road to check out my neighbor's house. They told me that there was no sign that the screen door had been broken into, and aside from the bloodstains, there was no sign of the intruder. They put out an alert to local hospitals for a man with a stab wound on his right arm. The following morning, the police brought a dog out to follow the scent, but whoever the lucky bastard was, he was never caught. I kept the cats at my place until my neighbor was out of the hospital. It still shakes me to my soul, the idea that the stranger chose that house in the middle of nowhere, trying to get inside. And if I hadn't got off the couch when I did, this may have ended very differently. Back in May of 2010, while in desperate need of cash, I agreed to house sit for one of my old high school teachers. He had contacted me via Facebook and asked me if I would be willing to water his plants, collect his mail, and clean up the place while he went out of town for a couple of days. He didn't specify where he was going, but he agreed to pay me $400 for 2.5 days, with half up front, so I agreed. I never really liked him in high school. He was teaching classic literature, and he always seemed to enjoy pointing out any illustrations that in any way featured nudity. His eyes always seemed hungry, and he tended to wheeze like he was out of breath, even though he was kind of a small guy. My friends and I used to refer to him as Mr. Liptit. When I arrived at his place, the key was beneath the mat, and $200 were in an envelope on the kitchen table. I turned on my music, watered the plants, cleaned and vacuumed the ground floor, and made myself dinner. I found his house to be extremely boring. It was filled with old books, stacks of newspapers, and ancient-looking furniture. that didn't really look comfortable to sit in. I settled into my sleeping bag on the guest bed, but I had a hard time staying asleep. It seemed that every 5 minutes there was another strange noise coming from the house, and it would put me on edge. The following morning, I went back to my own house, had breakfast, and took a shower before coming back and cleaning the second floor. Upon entering the guest bedroom, there was the faint smell of something in the air that definitely had not been there before. And what's more, I could have sworn that my sleeping bag was in a slightly different position when I had left it that morning. I started getting a bad vibe. I decided that night that I would sleep downstairs in the living room. I finished cleaning just after 10 p.m. I made some popcorn and enjoyed some cable TV, which I didn't have at my place. Around 11, I shut off the TV, wrapped myself up in my sleeping bag, and tried to drift off. I was tossing and turning for a bit, and just as I began to doze off, there came a click of the doorknob turning in the other room. I glanced over, and I swear by any god you choose, Mr. Liptak emerged from the pantry wearing only his socks. He then slowly turned the corner and made his way upstairs. I grabbed my phone and my keys and exited out the back door quietly. I ran around front to get into my car and sped home, where I immediately called the cops. I didn't know exactly how to explain the situation to them. I mean, he wasn't breaking and entering. It was his house. But when I explained to the operator that he had deceived me into thinking that he was gone, they sent out a patrol car. I had to collect the stuff that I had left at his house anyway. When the police arrived, Mr. Liptak answered the door wearing my sleeping bag over his shoulders. The police discovered a butler's cupboard, which was a secret room in the pantry that I wasn't aware of, where he had been hiding with a digital camera. He had taken a few dozen photos of me all around the house, most of which when I was sleeping. I showed the police the Facebook messages he sent me, assuring me that he would be out of town, and they arrested him. I collected all my remaining stuff, but left the sleeping bag. I didn't waste any time getting a restraining order against him. Mr. Liptak made bail, but actually died of a heart attack a few weeks later, after being rear-ended in his car at a stoplight. I never got the rest of my money. My one and only experience with a safe room happened in 2010. It was in a very nice house right on the beach on the west coast of Australia by the Timor Sea. It was my first year in college, and my entire political science class had been invited to a party to celebrate the resignation of the Prime Minister. I didn't know the host personally, but my teacher did, and despite the place being as big as a hotel, every room in the house was packed with guests, drinking, mingling, and making boring conversation. I barely knew anyone except for my classmates, so most of us drank some champagne out by the pool. And after a few of us had overindulged, we started daring each other to strip off some layers and jump into the water. After about six people were in the pool in their underwear splashing around and making noise, I figured any negative attention would be directed more at the people in the pool than around it. My bestie and I helped each other out of our dresses, and we sat at the side of the pool with our legs in the water. There was one younger guy around our age who I didn't recognize, who was nice enough to keep refilling our drinks while we sat and kicked our legs in the water. He said his name was Hugo, and my friend Tanya and I continued to make jokes about how he better not be spiking our drinks. He wasn't a servant or anything, he was just being nice. But we knew what he was after, of course, and we figured he would keep coming back to enjoy the view of us in our lacy underwear, waiting for us to get just drunk enough. To his disappointment, I imagine, we both knew when to cut ourselves off, and we eventually stood up and got dressed again, then went back inside. I mingled for another 40 minutes or so, and eventually lost track of Tanya. After returning from the bathroom, I noticed Hugo waiting for me patiently at the end of the hall. When I walked over to say hello, he produced a rose from behind his back. It was so sweet and cheesy that it actually melted my heart a bit. And we spent the next few minutes making out next to a grandfather clock in the hall. He paused for a moment and said that there was a more private place we could go, and I followed him into a back office that was unoccupied. At first, I was fine with it. I figured that he would just close the door and we would get frisky on the desk. The sounds of the party weren't far away, and there were plenty of windows, but instead he led me to a sliding door half hidden by a curtain, which opened into an even smaller office without windows. It had one desk, a chair, and a couch. I walked in for a peek, and it suddenly occurred to me what I was standing in. I asked, "Is this a panic room?" He nodded, and without hesitating, smacked a button on the wall, and a metal door slid shut with a thud. It was like an elevator door, but much heavier. He whispered, "No one can hear us in here," and began kissing my neck. I don't know if he meant that to be reassuring or not, but it came across as creepy. And I immediately broke away and said, "No way. I'm not doing this in here. Open the door." His expression was confused and hurt for a split second, and then he got irritated. He whispered, "Come on, don't be like that." I pivoted away from him, but he moved to intercept me and was blocking my way out. "Please, I get claustrophobic. Open the door." He kissed me and whispered, "Don't worry about it. Let's use the couch." He put his hands on my waist and tried to guide me to the couch, but I resisted. "Not until you open the door." That's when he put his hand on my stomach and physically pushed me back towards the couch. I distinctly remember thinking, okay, I tried to be nice. I had been harassed and stalked by a neighbor several years before, so I made it a habit to always have something on me to defend myself. I lowered my hands and popped a tiny false pearl off my ring, exposing the tiny pin underneath. I sat up on the couch and insisted one more time, in a stern voice, "I'm not kidding. Open the door." He lowered himself down to his knees and placed both hands on the inside of my thighs. When he leaned in, I cut the side of his face with my left hand and punched him as hard as I could with the right, burying the pin into his face. I didn't hit his eye, but I came pretty close. He immediately leapt back and started cursing and yowling like a cat does when you step on its tail. I jumped up and maneuvered around him. I hit the button and got the hell out of there. I shoved myself, not very gently, through the crowd until I found my teacher and a handful of other students in front of the hall. A few of them were leaving in their own cars. I immediately asked if I could catch a ride. I didn't tell anybody about what happened until later that night, when Tanya returned to the dorm. In retrospect, that was kind of a risky thing to do, because he could have potentially trapped another girl in there with him. But I figured that I had given him enough of a sting that he probably would be in no condition to get it up for the rest of the night. I never saw him again. I'm not entirely sure if his plan was to rape me, but if not, it was an awkward and creepy attempt at being romantic that severely backfired. Maybe if I was drunk, it would have worked. People may accuse me of being a tease and leading him on, but the fact is I just didn't feel comfortable in that room, and he was bigger than me, and didn't open the door after I persistently asked him to. I work for a private security company, and my primary job is a safe room technician. Basically, I am sent to test, do routine maintenance on, and repair or upgrade anything that needs service regarding a safe room or a bank vault. I've only had to physically break into a safe room twice in my life. Normally, removing people from the safety of one is a police matter, and usually just involves drilling a hole through a wall. Usually, people trying to evade the police in this manner eventually come out when they get hungry enough. Or in the case of an emergency, the police will toss in a smoke grenade through the hole they drilled. Once I was called in after the police negotiation failed, and a man shot himself in the room. I had to use a plasma cutter to cut away the outer door and disarm the locks. The man had fallen against the door, so when it slid open, he practically fell out on my feet. Dried blood was still caked over his face and clothes. But the second incident was far worse. A few years later, I was called in by local police to break open a safe room door in a basement. The house was on the market, and the real estate company had asked me to help get it open, so that they could present it to potential buyers. I told them that if it was locked, someone was likely inside. But they assured me that couldn't be the case, because no one had set foot on that property in months. I arrived at the house to inspect the room, taking into consideration that a power surge might have tripped something
and sealed the door shut. The agency didn't want me to damage the door, if at all possible, but after running a few tests on the control panel, I told them that it was sealed from the inside, and short of blowing it open and risking structural damage to the house, the only way in was me cutting through the door. They weren't happy about that, but I was more concerned that someone had killed themselves in there, and I was about to have another corpse fall out onto my shoes. After disarming all the locks and messing around with the control panel again, the door slid open, and the stench hit me immediately. On the carpeted floor, lying face down, was a withered corpse of a man. Both of his hands had been resting upon the inside of the door. The agency had gone through the local police to contact me, but they were not on scene. I called them right away, and they informed me not to let anyone enter the room. An investigation team showed up and questioned me. It turns out that the man's legs had been broken in 3 places each, most likely with a heavy instrument, such as a sledgehammer. He had been left to die in the room, being unable to sit up and reach the button to open the door. I went back and disassembled the control panel, and discovered the wiring behind it had been tampered with, potentially allowing someone to seal the door from the outside, if they knew what they were doing. That night I told my family about it. My brother-in-law's first words were, "Like the guy at the end of Saw?" And at those words, a sick, chilling feeling swept over me. Some poor man had been brutally attacked, and was left to slowly starve in a sealed room where there was no escape, and no one was anywhere near close enough to hear his calls for help. Not that anyone could have opened the door anyway. If the police ever arrested anyone for the murder, I was never informed. The real estate company kept the story quiet, so as not to dissuade anyone from viewing the house. Not that it mattered, as the place remained an open crime scene for quite some time afterwards. I told the cops that the killer may have been somebody with a history in my field, but they didn't seem convinced. I often wonder about that man, and how long it took him to die, all alone and in pain, knowing that he was never going to escape. I still wonder what the reason was, and who the last person he ever saw or thought about. It keeps things in perspective for me, and ever since that day, even on my worst days, I remind myself that at least I'm free and can look up and see the sun. People never believe me when I tell this story. My closest friends don't even believe me. My parents didn't believe it when they were alive. And even my own wife and kids doubt me. Back when I used to live in Nova Scotia, I worked for a man that would buy houses and flip them after renovating them. He would try to do a thorough inspection both before and after renovations took place, but there were normally a couple of houses he missed, and I was the one who was sent to inspect those. I don't remember the exact date, but it was in late July of 2000. The rain was pouring outside, and thunder was shaking the house. The roof had been retiled, and I was inspecting to see if there were any leaks, and if all the windows were watertight. I was alone in the house. I was sitting in a small office space which also served as a safe room. It was connected to the master bedroom, and the only way in and out of the safe room was through the bedroom. I was writing up my report and getting ready to leave, when I heard heavy footsteps on the stairs. I glanced up at the security feed on the TV in front of me. The security cameras had been set up the day before, and even though they were on, nothing had been set to record. I noticed a dark figure coming up the stairs from the kitchen towards the bedrooms. I knew that now the renovations were done, and only 3 people had the key to this house. The other 2 weren't anywhere near the place. Feeling slightly concerned, I pushed the button to the safe room door. I watched the monitors as the dark figure paused, as though it heard the rumble of the door shutting, and then it continued up to the landing. There were only 2 cameras on the 2nd floor, one at the top of the stairs, and 1 pointing down the hall. I watched as the dark figure seemed to glide down the hallway, peeking in each room, before entering the master bedroom. My blood turned to ice, and I turned around to look at the sealed door behind me. For several seconds, nothing happened. And then I distinctly heard the sound of a soft, reverberating thumping coming from outside the safe room. I turned back around and fixed my eyes on the monitor, but there was no camera angle to help me see what was happening. For several minutes, I sat there terrified, my eyes frozen to the screen, waiting for the figure to reemerge from the master bedroom. But it didn't. I broke out into a sweat and tried calling the police on my cell phone, but either because of the thick walls of the room or the storm outside, or possibly both, I couldn't get any reception. After another few minutes of staring at the screen, I stood up and cautiously made my way towards the door. I pressed my ear up to it and heard muttering from inside the bedroom. I didn't hear much, but one thing I distinctly heard was part of a sentence which sounded like,
"Bury you up to your neck."
And suddenly, another thump came on the door. I was terrified. Not only was this figure not leaving, but it seemed to know I was in there and wanted to hurt me. It was the longest night of my life. I stayed fixed in the chair, staring at the monitor practically non-stop, barely blinking for 6 hours, occasionally checking my phone for reception, but no one ever left the master bedroom. I would occasionally check the other cameras in the house, just in case I missed something, but I never saw any other movement. I finally broke down and dozed off for about 15 minutes before snapping awake again. Dawn had arrived, and light was beginning to fill the house. I didn't see the figure or any sign that it had left. Summoning up all my courage, I stood up. I took in a deep breath and opened the door, half convinced that I would be looking right into the eyes of a madman. I nearly had a heart attack when daylight hit my eyes, but there was no one in the room. Whoever had been there had vanished. I quickly gathered my things and shut the door behind me, and immediately my phone started buzzing, showing me that I had several missed calls. As I was about to leave the room, I glanced back and noticed a small red smear on the outside of the safe room door. It was barely an inch long, but noticeable enough for me to be certain that it hadn't been there the night before. I ran down to my car and floored it out of there. I never went back, but I later sent two of my friends back to the house to see if there had been any signs of forced entry, which there wasn't. My family is convinced that I had some kind of fever dream, but I know what happened, and the experience still traumatizes me to this day. I still get nervous about being all alone in large houses. Someone suggested that the figure may have been paranormal, like a spirit haunting the house, and I admit that that is a possibility, but I can't get over the red smear on the door. In my mind's eye, I can't stop visualizing a madman with a bloody face pressed to the door, leaving a nose print on its smooth surface, whispering menacingly,
"Bury you up to your neck."
Some backstory. This happened when my grandparents were in their early to mid-20s. My grandma worked at daycares and schools for a while, but she quit when she had kids of her own. She would have kind of an unofficial daycare babysitting job at their house, taking care of some of the neighbors' kids whose parents worked during the day. Some new neighbors had just moved in down the street, a husband and wife, and they had two kids of their own. This was the 1960s suburbia, very different times. They invited my grandparents over for dinner one night. The wife was showing my grandma around the house a bit, and as it turned out, they ran a daycare center from their house. She showed my grandma the room they used. Grandma had some trouble connecting with this woman, so of course she mentioned that she also ran a daycare at home. This woman immediately got angry with her, asking if it was official and licensed and whatnot. Well, it wasn't, and she explained to the woman that it really wasn't a daycare, just her babysitting for some neighbor kids at her house, and they were just calling it one. This seemed to calm the woman down, and they were able to have a normal dinner. Although the husband and wife kept recommending to my grandparents that they send over the neighbor kids, as well as my mom and uncle over to their house, as they were a accredited daycare center, instead of my grandma taking care of them. Well, dinner went fine, and my grandparents left, a little creeped out, but whatever. A few years later, my grandma was reading the paper and saw that the husband had been arrested for molesting children, his own, as well as the ones that were supposedly safe in their accredited daycare home. To this day, my grandma thinks that the reason that the woman was so defensive is because she knew something was going on with her husband.